Blog Talk Radio.
Spirit of Truth Ministry now presents The Bible on Trial, a show that tests the teachings of Christianity against the words and the teachings that Jesus Christ gave to his own eyewitness disciples while he was here on earth. Join us for a challenging and unique study into truth, justice, and the kingdom of heaven. Hello and welcome all. This is The Bible on Trial, and my name is Dennis, and I'm here with Dr. Don and Rick, and we are just about ready to get going. We're just about ready to get going on our program. Today is February 21, 2020, and we are delighted that you've taken a few minutes out of your busy schedule to join us for our program. I have put up on our chat room all of the information you need to know in order to get to our websites, and we encourage you to go there and take a look around. We also encourage you to go to our Facebook page. It's Spirit of Truth Ministry Group, and if you go there and have not already requested to become a member of the group, I suggest that you do so, and every once in a while we put up some interesting writing, especially the program notes, the episode info for the programs that we do each and every Friday and Sabbath. Let's have prayer and we'll get started. Father in heaven, Jesus Christ, Holy Spirit, grant that we will today understand your words through Jesus Christ and his Spirit. And I pray, Father, that that truth will go into our hearts, into our minds, into our intellect, and create in us a clean heart so that we can be perfect, even as our Father in heaven is perfect. I pray this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
And good morning, Rick. It's nice to see you over there. And we will be excited to hear what you have to say today.
So will I. The last time we were discussing Revelation 10, and I think it was then that I ran out of time, and just before we ran out of time, I was saying that I would talk about the difference between legalistic and law-abiding. A good example of legalistic is the religious elite at the time when the Son of God was here on earth. The religious elite had created a legalistic spiritual practice. Every element of the law had been defined, and I don't want to say redefined. Every element of the law had been defined in minute detail according to their own wisdom. And when I say there, I'm talking about the religious elite, not just the ones alive at the time when the Son of God was testifying, because this had started a long time ago, and I've read that text from Jeremiah about the lying pen of the scribes that had turned the law of God into a lie. A legalistic spiritual religio practice is one where the religious elite, and when I talk about the religious elite, I'm talking about those who have received authority to control, manipulate, and administer the practices for the sheep, their flock, their congregation, their membership. And as long as they can keep these people like sheep from knowing the facts in the matter, the truth, they can control them with their lies. This is a legalistic religious practice. It is what the law of God is turned into so that man can control it. And God has no longer any part in the law that is being enforced by the religious elite.
And they are trying to control the outcomes. They want to have control of the outcome for every single person under their thumb.
And the reason is, Dennis, and that's a good point. The reason is, you'd say, well, why? You know, why? Well, first of all, if you control the information, you can control the flow of money into your coffers.
Exactly.
I have heard more than one pastor or priest or quote-unquote holy man use words that are fully intended to use a colloquial expression, fleece the flock. Tithe is a good example.
Oh, and Don is a big... Don wrote a great paper and did some research on tithing, which I find fascinating.
Your pastor will tell you the tithe belongs to God. And if you don't pay it, you are robbing God. And when you rob God, he knows it. And that is the highest of crimes. So if you don't want to burn in hell, if you want eternal life, you had better fork over your tithe, every penny of it. And not only that, but the offerings are also a requirement, even though it's not specifically stated in there. The offering is, they say, a requirement. This is a legalistic religious teaching. When you look at the tithe requirement, it was specifically for the priests in Israel, and it was necessary because God wanted the priests to not have to work in the fields to grow crops for themselves so that they could sell the crops and also use the crops for their own food. And when you read in Malachi and it talks about the tithe, bring ye all the tithe into the storehouse that there may be food in my house. Well, the storehouse is where you put the grain, and the grain is what you made the bread with, and the bread is what you ate. God wanted the priests to spend their time learning the truth and delivering the law, the truth, to the people. The priests, on the other hand, were more into control, because through control they could get more money out of the people. Why do you think that the widow in the parable, or whether it was a account of a truthful event, have you heard of the widow's mite? It was all she had, and she put it in the offering plate. And the Son of God used this as an example. What would, I mean, God never said you had to give everything you owned. And this, according to the account, is all the woman had.
And how do you tithe a mite?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
How do you tithe a mite? It is the smallest coin of the time. It was like a penny.
You've heard the account where the Son of God said to the religious elite, you tithe mint, dill, and cumin, which you should have done, but you neglected the weightier portions of the law. People have asked about tithe today. And as I understand it, the purpose and use of the tithe is no longer valid. There are no priests in Israel. There are no priests whose sole job is to make sure that God's chosen people learn the law so that they can behave in accordance with his will.
And there are no priests or pastors or teachers today that are teaching anything like the truth. So why would God fund them for teaching something that was not true?
That's my point. And the other thing is, what is mint, dill, and cumin?
Spices.
Little. I mean, it's not wheat and it's not barley. They're just spices. What are the weightier parts of the law? The weightier parts of the law are: love the Lord thy God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your strength, and your neighbor as yourself. Law abiding is that. legalistic for all intents and purposes is only used to increase the wealth of the religious elite.
And the other thing is if you go back into the Old Testament, and Don would be much more adept at this. One of the main things about tithing was to go to take your tithe. If you could take the tithe physically, fine. If not, convert it to money and go where God tells you. And in the early years, this was Shiloh. It wasn't, that was where the heads of the religious leadership met and party before the Lord.
Celebrate.
Have a party. What was told to Israel was go ahead and eat and drink and have a joyous time before the Lord with your tithe.
Okay, for our new listeners, read Deuteronomy 14. There it's all explained, and I can guarantee you nobody's ever heard a sermon on that.
No kidding.
Read Deuteronomy 14.
Yep.
There it is. No sermons on that.
Now, we're not told, and it really doesn't matter, but I would say that absence speaks volumes, or silence speaks volumes, whatever. The Son of God did not go around collecting people's tithe.
You're kidding.
People contributed money to him because they wanted to. Now, there is a misconception that he was poor and didn't have any money, and that's why he slept outside most of the time.
And that is exactly what I was just about to say. We have been taught that Jesus was a pauper, that when they went to Egypt, when he was a boy of two, and they had to escape, they had nothing. They were refugees. All you have to do is look at the coat, the cloak that he wore. Why would the Roman soldiers cast lots for that coat?
Well, it was seamless, which meant that it was
it was woven.
Tremendously expensive.
Incredibly expensive.
But the other thing is who was the treasurer? Who was Jesus' treasurer?
And if you think that Judas would have been risking his reputation,
Judas, we know, was skimming.
It was skimming
because the disciples all said they knew that he was skimming.
If there was a couple
of mites in the treasury in the bag, Judas would have had nothing to do with Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least being his treasurer, since he kept the money. You can't skim out of a treasury
that has nothing in it.
I heard a great presentation years ago. And it fits right in here. After Jesus was born, the three wise men came from the east to seek out a pauper, or what were they seeking?
King.
Right.
Yes.
And they were bringing gifts to a king. And one of those gifts was gold. They didn't bring a couple of little gold coins. They brought a massive amount of gold. And it was suggested that probably that gold went with the family when they went to Egypt. That was a huge amount of gold. What happened? What happened to that gold?
And also, frankincense and myrrh were probably worth much more by weight than what gold was.
Exactly.
And
so that's an interesting insight.
And as a side, in what country was the financial center of the world at the time?
Probably Egypt.
It was Egypt. So here we have Joseph taking his family to the financial center of the world with lots and lots of wealth, and they stayed there for quite a while, and I am certain that there was no lack of investment ability.
Well, also know that
Uncle Joe
was a carpenter. And a carpenter in those days was a very lucrative profession.
No kidding. And they were called joiners, because what they did was they built all of their wood tables and chairs and all that without fasteners.
Without nails. So what God is looking for are people who will commit to being law-abiding. And he will have nothing to do with those who either promote or hold to legalism and legalistic.
Now, just to make a small distinction, and I know you're going to get there, there is a huge difference between being legal and being lawful.
Yeah, it's one is a definition, the other one is the practice. Legalistic spiritual practices have driven more people away from God and, in effect, have made them hardened against God. Any God that would do that kind of thing, I am not going to worship, is not even worthy of worship. And what they don't realize is the God that they have been told does those things to people in a legalistic practice is not the true loving God in the heavens. It is the false God, small g, who knows that if he can get people to believe that what he is requiring is from the true God, they will turn away from the true God because of the false representation, and then he has them. The devil uses projection all the time. Now, let me say that one more time, because I want you to get this. The devil et al. Uses projection all of the time. That is how he conducts his warfare, and it is a spiritual warfare. In order to project, you have to have words. You can't project without them. Words are the artillery that are used in the battle that the evil one is conducting against the righteous, true, and holy God. What you see happening in this country, the United States, right now, is not just a conflict between opposing or different ideologies or political preference. It is not right and left. It is not Republican and Democrat. It is evil and good. And what the evil forces do and have always done is they project their crimes onto the other side, onto the side of truth. And those who are in the middle are never informed of the truth. In fact, the truth is always hidden from them. It must be hidden from them if the liars are in control. Because the only way that liars can stay in control is to redact the truth. And to keep the truth from the light of day. And then work very hard at saying that they are the right, they are the good, they are the truthful, and project all of their evil acts on the other side. That is happening today, and it has been happening now out in the open for the last almost 3.5 years. The dark has always been in control. The darkness has always been in control since Lucifer determined to take his own way and foist it onto humanity. Darkness has been the atmosphere on this earth for a long time. And we're told in John chapter 1 that the light, who is also the word, who is also the truth, left his home in the heavens, where he lived with his father and his mother. And he came into the darkness, which existed and still exists on this earth. He came into the darkness and used his light to light others. So that when he went back to his father and he sent his mother here to continue what he started, that the light that he gave to his disciples and those who were of the larger group who accompanied him much of the time when he was here on earth, the light that he gave them, they would give to others. But the darkness worked very, very hard, diligently, to limit the extent that the light could reach. God wants and needs every human being to have had and to have an opportunity to be exposed to the light of truth so that they can make a determination and a decision based on the facts to accept or reject the truth. That is going on right now. And I imagine that shortly God will begin to act directly in this world. When the faithful and wise bondservant and the fellow bondservants receive the command to go out and present the truth to the people of earth. I've talked about reality choice. Last weekend, I went over what God said, that his dealings with the people of earth would be depending upon what they chose. And right in all of that, God makes a very interesting statement, which I haven't heard anywhere. He says, then I will change my mind about what I was going to do. I want you to think about that. Then I will change my mind about what I was going to do. That's Jeremiah 12. And it's verses 14 through 17. Thus says Yahweh, as for all my evil neighbors who have laid hands on the heritage I granted my people Israel. That's not the one. Jeremiah chapter 18. Sorry about that. and 7 through 11. On occasion, I decree for some nation, for some kingdom, that I will tear up, knock down, destroy. But if, and remember I point out that whenever God says something, this is what I'm going to do, this is what I'm going to do. And then after he has said that, if he says, but if, then everything he just said is a conditional statement. But if this nation, against which I have promised sentence or pronounced sentence, abandons its wickedness, I then change my mind about the evil which I had intended to inflict on it. And then he goes on to say, but if I've decreed building up and prosperity, but that nation does what displeases me, I will change my mind about the good that I had planned for them. My question is this. When God said this, was he putting it in the context of any time frame? In other words, what he says here, does this only apply back in the time before the Son of Man came to earth to testify? Or would it fall in the same category that the Son of God, when he made a statement about the law and the prophets, and he said, not the least stroke of the pen or the smallest letter will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Does this statement, is it included in the law and the prophet statement that not the least letter or stroke of the pen will change? The reason,
you know, and you know that, by the way, that comes Matthew, that comes from Matthew 5:17-18 in that neck of the woods. Matthew 5:18, Jesus said, for truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all has been accomplished. And the question then is, has all been accomplished? Not so far as I can tell.
So what do I mean? Why, how is that applying here? Or does it apply here? Well, one thing I know is that the prophecies of Daniel that applied to the end were sealed up. And we are not told when they are unsealed. We are told they're sealed up until the end of days. And the end of days is here. But I think that the start of the time, which would be the end of days, would be with the announcement there would be no, or the delay is over. And why do we have a delay? I have offered a few suggestions as to why we have a delay.
I think one of them is that the bride is not ready.
Well, that's true. But what happens right after the angel in Revelation 10, the mighty angel, says in a loud voice, the time of waiting is over. There will be no more delay.
Correct.
The delay has ended. What happens? There's this, that angel goes on to say, in the days when the seventh angel is about to sound, the secret intention of God will be revealed. Just as he said to his
servants,
the prophets.
Revelation 10:7.
And then John is instructed to take the scroll from the angel's hand and eat it. He is told before he eats it that it will turn his stomach bitter, but in his mouth it will be sweet as honey. Two opposites not joined. What is contained in that scroll that is open in the angel's hand? And why do you think that we are told that scroll is open?
Well, there is prophecy in that scroll
that has already been written, but not revealed,
right.
Now, listen closely.
You must.
The seven thunders sounded, and John heard what they said, and he was about to write it down, and he was told, do not write it down. If what the seven thunders said, that information is what is written on that scroll, and John heard it, would that mean that the scroll had been opened? In other words, the information had already been given, which is why the scroll was open. It just hadn't been revealed. It was sealed up until when?
The appointed time of the end. When it would be necessary for the faithful and wise servant and his fellow servants to know it.
So what could be so important, so critical, so different, that to know it ahead of time would
have
affected the end?
It would have given away the playbook, and the enemy would have been able to counter it.
Would the information in this open scroll be a prophecy about a future, a reality that would come about if God had changed his mind about the people living at the last day? If the people had changed their ways and had chosen a reality path that was more in line with his will, than what they would have done if they had not made that decision.
I hearken back to Nineveh when Jonah got mad at God for changing his mind. In fact, he was all set up on the hill overlooking Nineveh. He was ready for a big light show, fire and brimstone and all that stuff. And when God didn't do it, he complained. Why was Nineveh not destroyed at that moment? Because the whole city changed their attitude.
And doesn't God say that, don't I have a right to change my mind? He says that to Jonah.
Right.
Because Jonah is like, wait a minute, God. Well, what do you mean? Yeah, you've made me look like a fool.
No.
That's why I was running away. I know you do things like this.
No, Jonah, you were doing a fine job of that all by yourself.
think of how Jonah felt.
That's the first submarine ride.
But you see, God never changes. And it's interesting that God chose Jonah. Because you would think that was that the best person for the job? Why did he choose Jonah? And God told Jonah, you tell those people that I am going to destroy the whole city and all of them with it. They are all going to be destroyed. Why would God, if he was going to do that, why would he send someone to warn them that he was going to do that? Because Jonah wasn't saying you need to change your ways. That, as I read Jonah, I don't see where Jonah is saying God is going to do this unless you change your ways. He just says God is going to do this because you are wicked, and he is going to destroy this whole city. It's the king who says, I don't want this to happen. And the king orders the whole city, and it says, from the king in his palace to the lowest slave in his hut, they all put on sackcloth and ashes. They all humbled themselves before God. They all presented their case and pleaded for him to change his mind. Exactly what God said to Jeremiah. If a nation against which I have promised death and destruction, if they change their ways and humble themselves, and if they do this, I will change my mind about the destruction that I had planned for them.
So back to the question, why was Jonah asked to go there?
He was asked to go there. He was told to go there to tell the king of Israel, unless they changed their ways, God was going to wipe them out. And when they changed their ways, God didn't wipe them out.
And Jonah didn't know that God would ever change his mind once he had said, this is what I'm going to do, da-da-da-da-da. So what does that mean for us today? Well, I think that what that means is that right now there is
a change
occurring. And the devil and those who follow and worship and serve him know it. And they are fighting like hell to keep it from happening. What is it? It is what you see in the people of earth today. It is people who are making a stand for what is right. They may not know the truth, and most of them don't, but they want to know the truth. They haven't blinded themselves to the truth. And one of the most unlikely of individuals, like Jonah was, one of the most unlikely of individuals, has, in essence, picked up the mantle to lead the way, to fight the fight against evil, the devil, the demons, the cabal, the occult, to fight the fight against them with what? What is he using to fight with? Information, which information is conveyed through what?
Words.
Words. And the people are listening.
And by the way, sometimes harsh and sometimes crude, but they are truth.
And he is, and I've used this a few times before, and I've heard some people say that too. If you walk into a dark room where there is a nest of cockroaches, and you flip the light on, what do the cockroaches do?
They run for the dark.
They run for the dark. And the same thing happens with rats. If you turn the light on a rat's nest, the rats run for the exits. Those who love the dark and live in the dark want to keep it dark. But those who have grown up in the dark but see a light would much rather go to the light and live in the light and forsake the darkness forever. And that is what I see happening.
I find it fascinating, Rick, that the Christian church, the central tenet of the Christian church, according to them, is found in John 3:16. And everybody knows it. Everybody knows that verse. What they don't recognize, and most of them have never read, and we have read, I don't know, countless times on this program, is John 3:19 through 21, which define exactly what you have been saying. So I'm going to read it. John 3:19 through 21. This is the judgment, that light has come into the world and men loved the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. For everyone who does evil hates the light and does not come to the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But he who practices the truth comes to the light so that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought in God. And you mentioned cockroaches in the dark and the light being turned on them. That is exactly what we have been seeing today. The light has been turned on the cockroaches and they are running for cover and they hate it and they are blistering
the one who's bringing the light.
The one who's bringing the light.
And they're accusing the one who's bringing the light of being the villain and the criminal, just as they did in the days when the Son of God was here on earth. They accused him of promoting darkness and evil, and that is why they condemned him to death, because he was a direct threat to their power and their control.
He was a clear and present danger to their power and control.
We are on the threshold of entering a reality that has not been revealed yet. We are on the threshold of a reality of peace and prosperity. And the information, the prophecy concerning that reality has not been revealed yet, but the information we know is there because God put it in prophecy. It is called the Seven Thunders. We don't know what it says, but we know that it is there. And I want to make this observation. God knew the choice that people would make in the end of days. That's why he's delaying this. He knew the choice that people would make. That's why he put Revelation 10, of course it wasn't, there were no chapters at that time, but Revelation 10 is in the heart of Revelation, right in the middle. That's why he gives a hint there could be a change in plan. The only thing that causes God to change his mind, I just read to you, if a nation or a world changes their attitude and begin to recognize him, acknowledge his way, and to learn to follow it, he will change his mind about the destruction he had planned. The judgment is coming, but the reality that ends with that judgment will be a reality that we have not had revealed to us yet.
Unlooked for.
But God will reveal that reality. He will let us know what the sweetness in the mouth is and what turns the stomach bitter. It turns bitter in the stomach. He will let us know that. What we must do is continue on the path to light that has already been started. And I see that people, if you look at the poll numbers, it looks like people are waking up and they are choosing the path of truth and light.
Thank you, Rick, and thank you all for being here today. We will be back tomorrow at 10 a.m. Pacific time on Blog Talk Radio at this same location. You can find us there tomorrow at 10 a.m. for the Revelation of Jesus with Rick Sterling. We also encourage you to go to our websites. Primary website is spiritoftruthministry.net, And our secondary website is spiritoftruthministry.net/S, T, M. So on behalf of Spirit of Truth Ministry, this is Dennis Neufeld wishing you all a good day, and we will see you all tomorrow. Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. Everyone have a great day.